subsection 3. Thus the law stood until Austin. Austin upheld a direct restriction on the independent expenditure of funds for political speech for the first time in this court's history. There, the Michigan Chamber of Commerce sought to use general treasury funds to run a newspaper ad supporting a specific candidate. Michigan law, however, prohibited corporate independent expenditures that supported or opposed any candidate for state office. A violation of the law was punishable as a felony. The court sustained the speech prohibition. To bypass Buckley and Bellotti, the Austin court identified a new governmental interest in limiting political speech, an anti-distortion interest. Austin found a compelling governmental interest in preventing the corrosive and distorting effects of immense aggregations of wealth that are accumulated with the help of the corporate form and that have little or no correlation to the public's support for the corporation's political ideas. Section B. The court is thus confronted with conflicting lines of precedent. A pre-Austin line that forbids restrictions on political speech based on the speaker's corporate identity, and a post-Austin line that permits them. No case before Austin had held that Congress could prohibit independent expenditures for political speech based on the speaker's corporate identity. Before Austin, Congress had enacted legislation for this purpose, and the government urged the same proposition before this court. In neither of these cases did the court adopt the proposition. In its defense of the corporate speech restrictions in Section 441B, the government notes the anti-distortion rationale on which Austin and its progeny rest in part, yet it all but abandons reliance upon it. It argues instead that two other compelling interests support Austin's holding that corporate expenditure restrictions are constitutional, an anti-corruption interest and a shareholder protection interest. We consider the three points in turn. Subsection 1. As for Austin's anti-distortion rationale, the government does little to defend it, and with good reason, for the rationale cannot support Section 441B. If the First Amendment has any force, it prohibits Congress from fining or jailing citizens or associations of citizens for simply engaging in political speech. If the anti-distortion rationale were to be accepted, however, it would permit government to ban political speech simply because the speaker is an association that has taken on the corporate form. The government contends that Austin permits it to ban corporate expenditures for almost all forms of communication stemming from a corporation. If Austin were correct, the government could prohibit a corporation from expressing political views in media beyond those presented here, such as by printing books. The government responds that the FEC has never applied the statute to a book, and if it did, there would be quite a good as-applied challenge. This troubling assertion of brooding governmental power cannot be reconciled with the confidence and stability in civic discourse that the First Amendment must secure. Political speech is indispensable to decision-making in a democracy, and this is no less true because the speech comes from a corporation rather than an individual. This protection for speech is inconsistent with Austin's anti-distortion rationale. Austin sought to defend the anti-distortion rationale as a means to prevent corporations from obtaining an unfair advantage in the political marketplace by using resources amassed in the economic marketplace. But Buckley rejected the premise that the government has an interest in equalizing the relative ability of individuals and groups to influence the outcome of elections. Buckley was specific in stating that the skyrocketing cost of political campaigns could not sustain the governmental prohibition. The First Amendment's protections do not depend on the speaker's financial ability to engage in public discussion. The court reaffirmed these conclusions when it invalidated the BCRA provision that increased the cap on contributions to one candidate if the opponent made certain expenditures from personal funds. The rule that political speech cannot be limited based on a speaker's wealth is a necessary consequence of the premise that the First Amendment generally prohibits the suppression of political speech based on the speaker's identity. Either as support for its anti-distortion rationale or as a further argument, the Austin majority undertook to distinguish wealthy individuals from corporations on the ground that state law grants corporations special advantages, such as limited liability, perpetual life, and favorable treatment of the accumulation and distribution of assets. This does not suffice, however, to allow laws prohibiting speech. It is rudimentary that the state cannot exact as the price of those special advantages the forfeiture of First Amendment rights. It is irrelevant for purposes of the First Amendment that corporate funds may have little or no correlation to the public support for the corporation's political ideas. All speakers, including individuals in the media, use money amassed from the economic marketplace to fund their speech. The First Amendment protects the resulting speech even if it was enabled by economic transactions with persons or entities who disagree with the speaker's ideas. Austin's anti-distortion rationale would produce the dangerous and unacceptable consequence that Congress could ban political speech of media corporations. Media corporations are now exempt from Section 441B's ban on corporate expenditures. Yet media corporations accumulate wealth with the help of the corporate form. The largest media corporations have immense aggregations of wealth, and the views expressed by media corporations often have little or no correlation to the public's support for these views. Thus, under the government's reasoning, wealthy media corporations could have their voices diminished to put them on par with other media entities. There is no precedent for permitting this under the First Amendment. The media exemption discloses further difficulties with the law now under consideration. There is no precedent supporting laws that attempt to distinguish between corporations which are deemed to be exempt as media corporations and those which are not. We have consistently rejected the proposition that the institutional press has any constitutional privilege beyond that of other speakers. With the advent of the Internet and the decline of print and broadcast media, moreover, the line between the media and others who wish to comment on political and social issues becomes far more blurred. The law's exception for media corporations is on its own terms all but an admission of the invalidity of the anti-distortion rationale. And the exemption results in a further separate reason for finding this law invalid. Again, by its own terms, the law exempts some corporations but covers others, even though both have the need or the motive to communicate their views. The exemption applies to media corporations owned or controlled by corporations that have diverse and substantial investments and participate in endeavors other than news. So even assuming the most doubtful proposition that a news organization has a right to speak when others do not, the exemption would allow a conglomerate that owns both a media business and an unrelated business to influence or control the media in order to advance its overall business interest. At the same time, some other corporation with an identical business interest but no media outlet in its ownership structure would be forbidden to speak or inform the public about the same issue. This differential treatment cannot be squared with the First Amendment. There is simply no support for the view that the First Amendment, as originally understood, would permit the suppression of political speech by media corporations. The framers may not have anticipated modern business and media corporations, yet television networks and major newspapers owned by media corporations have become the most important means of mass communication in modern times. The First Amendment was certainly not understood to condone the suppression of political speech in society's most salient media. It was understood as a response to the repression of speech in the press that had existed in England and the heavy taxes on the press that were imposed in the colonies. The great debates between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists over our founding document were published and expressed in the most important means of mass communication of that era, newspapers owned by individuals. At the founding, speech was open, comprehensive, and vital to society's definition of itself. There were no limits on the sources of speech and knowledge. The framers may have been unaware of certain types of speakers or forms of communication, but that does not mean that those speakers and media are entitled to less First Amendment protection than those types of speakers and media that provided the means of communicating political ideas when the Bill of Rights were adopted. Austin interferes with the open marketplace of ideas protected by the First Amendment. It permits the government to ban the political speech of millions of associations of citizens. Most of these are small corporations without large amounts of wealth. This fact belies the government's argument that the statute is justified on the ground that it prevents the distorting effects of immense aggregations of wealth. It is not even aimed at amassed wealth. The censorship we now confront is vast in its reach. The government has muffled the voices that best represent the most significant segments of the economy, and the electorate has been deprived of information, knowledge, and opinion vital to its function. By suppressing the speech of manifold corporations, both for-profit and non-profit, the government prevents their voices and viewpoints from reaching the public and advising voters on which persons or entities are hostile to their interests. Factions will necessarily form in our republic, but the remedy of destroying the liberty of some factions is worse than the disease. Factions should be checked by permitting them all to speak and by entrusting the people to judge what is true and what is false. The purpose and effect of this law is to prevent corporations, including small and non-profit corporations, from presenting both facts and opinions to the public. This makes Austin's anti-distortion rationale all the more an aberration. The First Amendment protects the right of corporations to petition legislative and administrative bodies. Corporate executives and employees counsel members of Congress and presidential administrations on many issues as a matter of routine and often in private. An amicus brief filed on behalf of Montana and 25 other states notes that lobbying and corporate communications with elected officials occur on a regular basis. When that phenomenon is coupled with Section 441B, the result is that smaller or nonprofit corporations cannot raise a voice to object when other corporations, including those with vast wealth, are cooperating with the government. That cooperation may sometimes be voluntary, or it may be at the demand of a government official who uses his or her authority, influence, and power to threaten corporations to support the government's policies. Those kinds of interactions are often unknown and unseen. The speech that Section 441B forbids, though, is public, and all can judge its content and purpose. References to massive corporate treasuries should not mask the real operation of this law. Rhetoric ought not obscure reality. Even if Section 441B's expenditure ban were constitutional, wealthy corporations could still lobby elected officials, although smaller corporations may not have the resources to do so. And wealthy individuals and unincorporated associations can spend unlimited amounts on independent expenditures. Yet certain disfavored associations of citizens, those that have taken on corporate form, are penalized for engaging in the same political speech. When government seeks to use its full power, including the criminal law, to command where a person may get his or her information, or what distrusted source he or she may not hear, it uses censorship to control thought. This is unlawful. The First Amendment confirms the freedom to think for ourselves.